Hello, and welcome to Be Creator, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the creator economy. I'm Alice Audley, and I'm the founder of Be Creator, formerly known as Blogosphere. Be Creator are the UK's specialists in creator events. We run category-specific shows, such as the Beauty, Travel, and Health and Wellbeing Creator Show, which bring together brands, talent managers, and creators for a day of exhibitions, panels, presentations, and networking. And we also run the Be Creator Awards, our flagship event, which celebrates the best UK creators and creator marketing campaigns of the year. Last year's event had a reach of 179 million. If you would like to see some information about our events and how to get involved, head over to becreator.co.uk. Now, on to the show. Today on Be Creator, Serious Influence, I'm joined by Lucy Loveridge, who is the Managing Director of YMU's Social Division.
Hello, Alice. My name is Lucy Loveridge and I'm Global MD of Social at YMU.
And how did you get this role? Take us back. How did your career start? How did you find yourself in the world of creator?
So I started my career in advertising. I thought marketing was vaguely interesting. Ended up at an ad agency and went through a couple of those. Actually in the sort of retail sector, so I worked on Asda and Tesco, which is actually quite interesting and relevant for bits of what I do now.
What was the name of the company's ad agencies?
The first one was called Lateral.
Okay.
There's one in Leeds called Greta Palm.
So it was in Leeds that...
Yeah, so I'm from Newcastle. I sort of worked my way down the country from Newcastle to Leeds to Hertfordshire to London at ad agencies, all small, to be honest. And then I'd got into, around 2010, sort of discovered the world of beauty blogging and YouTube at that point. So Sam and Nick Chapman, Tanya Burr, and many
through
more.
Through work or through hobby?
Through hobby.
Yeah.
I can't even really remember how I found it. I'd sort of always been quite internet geeky generally. I think it's probably just through that. But I'd moved to London for my job and I met Dom Smales at a party that he was hosting for a beauty brand. And we'd always known each other because he'd, you know, sent me shampoo previously and things like that. So it was a bit silly. But
when he was... At Gleam or in his previous...
When he just started Gleam. So he just started Gleam and he was consulting for a few brands, one of which was Unilever. It was like Unilever, Avon, Chanel. It was all
quite good starting brands.
Amazing starting brands. And also hilarious because, you know, he's a guy who doesn't wear makeup. And bumped into him at this event that he'd invited me to. And he was like, why are you living in London and working in Hertfordshire? That's not... You should come work for me. And so started work, left my old job after 6 weeks, which went down terribly.
Wow.
Yeah, not good. And started working for Dom, which felt like a bit of a punt at the time because it was sort of Gleam was in its infancy and it was very much consultancy for beauty brands. But that sort of tied in with my advertising background.
How many were you sort of employee number?
One. Yeah, there'd been like freelancers before because there'd been a bit of community management. But I think I was the first... full-time. So yeah, and then that's how I got into it. And very quickly that turned from consultancy for beauty brands. Dom was sort of starting to manage these creators on the side, just out of interest.
What year is this?
2012. And yeah, very after 6 months, I was like, okay, I'm now going to help on the talent side of things. And so that's what we did.
So Sam and Nick were the first talent that were signed to
So it was Sam and Nick, Tanya, Jim, Ruth Crilly, The Lean Machines, Wayne Goss at that point. Yeah. I think that was probably the roster.
And then it absolutely exploded and was at the forefront and you had those magical, like 2013, 2014 was when it hit sort of mainstream. What was it like to be on that ride?
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really amazing. I feel like 2017 was the peak year. Maybe it was 2016, I don't know, because I think we spent a lot of the first couple of years knocking on doors. And you know what it's like when you're starting something new, and especially in an industry where it hadn't really been done in the UK before. There were MCNs, absolutely, but there wasn't management for creators in the UK. There was in the US, and we sort of, you know, could see the model that was working there, and I'm still friends with lots of the people who were managing creators in the US at that time. But, you know, we had to explain to Penguin that there would be demand for a book, for example. And sort of met with a lot of scepticism.
That's when Alfie's book was released and shut down Piccadilly. That's with 11,000 people. Didn't have to get a helicopter.
Yeah, it's bad.
People don't listen.
But it was great because, I mean, it was stressful. That was stressful, but it proved that the demand was there. And now the industry is so established and I mean, it's still in its infancy. Let's not, you know, get that wrong. But it's so much more established now. So many more people work in it.
So you started, moved over to helping with the talent. And then what were your job roles?
Yeah, so I sort of started off as technically an account manager, but then became a talent manager. I guess grew as the business grew. There was two of us. By the time I left, there was about 60 of us, 70 of us.
How did you find that transition from going from a small team to lots and lots of people? Is it exciting? I suppose it has hurdles with it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the culture at Gleam was great. We had a great time. And I enjoy the people management aspect as well as the talent bit.
Yeah.
So I sort of ended up in a more management role.
Your final position was that MD.
Yeah, managing partner.
Yeah.
That's what the parent company call that title. Yeah, it was brilliant. It was really, really enjoyable. 10 years, essentially.
10 years,
yeah,
wow.
9 and a half.
So you left Gleam when?
August 21.
And how did it feel after being somewhere for 10 years? That's a big old stint.
Yeah, I always had this vision when I was younger. I was like, I'll leave everywhere after 2 years because that's how you, you know, succeed in life. And I think I just stayed there for so long. It's just because I enjoyed it. But I was ready to learn some new stuff. And I think that's a it's the reason that I've moved to IMU. So I'm like, I know what I know about the creator economy, but I don't know anything about traditional entertainment, really. I know such a small amount.
Yeah.
And I have so much to learn, and wouldn't that be valuable knowledge and insight to bring to, you know, the creators that we could represent there?
So you left, had a break, then started at YMU, and your position there is?
Managing Director.
Managing Director. There we go. That was where the MD was. And talking about traditional celebrity and then creators, we have seen, I mean, probably with Joe Sugg on Strictly, that there has been that, you know, trials. It hasn't always been smooth. Do you think that we're about to see a new era? And we kind of are with the talent. Like, you know, talk about what talent do you have on YMU's books? It feels like you've got some serious big hitters.
Yeah, we've tried to bring on talent that makes sense for the wider YMU business. YMU is big business. There's 400 people work there across 5 offices and 1,000 clients. It's big business and it's built to service big talent. So when we're looking at talent to bring onto the roster, it makes sense to bring on those who will benefit from the fact that there's a whole commercial team, an IP team, a literary division. Like, there's so many people with really specific expertise. That sort of bringing on a client who is just going to do brand deals, it's sort of a waste of the resource and expertise that's in-house. So we've ended up signing some, hopefully you agree, great talent.
Yeah.
Including actually lots of podcasters. So Jamie Lang is one of those sort of podcast aficionado. And I think the interesting thing around podcasting specifically is people are growing podcasts through social now, and that was Jamie's strategy, and he's really good at it, really, really good at it. And I don't know if I can swear, but Shits and Gigs, their official name, SNG. They're another example of grown phenomenally quickly on social, which has driven listenership of the podcast. And through that, you can do so much. You can do merch, you can do touring, you can do branded, you know, segments of anything, you can do branded live shows. There's so much you've got to work with. We sort of inadvertently ended up with quite a few podcasters. But
in terms of the sort of revenue split on merch, brand partnerships, would you say that it's actually the live shows and the touring that sort of is more remunerative?
No, I think it's still
a blend.
It's still a blend. I think brand partnerships continue to be a huge driving revenue driving part of the creator economy generally, but the touring is more of a great way to connect with the audience,
relationships,
and build a relationship and sort of I guess positioning from a talent perspective.
And you have Amelia, the juggernaut.
We do, I know.
Who exponential success.
Yes, she's one of those examples. It's like Munya Chihuahua is the same. Yeah. It's like they've been doing it for such a long time, and then suddenly everybody's like, "Wow, this person's come from nowhere.
Overnight success." Yeah. Like, no.
They're both doing phenomenally. Really exciting.
Talent on your books then have access to all the different divisions in YMU.
Yeah, we all work really closely. And so Jamie's a really good example. He is from TV. So it was really important that as part of his core team, he had somebody with the TV expertise. So Martha, one of our colleagues on the entertainment division, also works on Jamie.
Mm. And you've got Sophie, his fiancée as well.
Yes, Sophie Habu, who's brilliant. And as I say to Jamie, she is the talent in that relationship, which she loves. She's hilarious and very good at podcasting and social as well. So
I think that out of sort of reality TV, which is what started, many don't end up having that connection, but they have sort of cut through in that respect. Why have they sort of made it, whereas others haven't?
Jamie's fanatical about podcasting and content, and he is also a prolific consumer in a positive way, but he's watching what everybody's doing and is interested, and wherever they're from, there's no sort of snobbiness about, you know, he'll have a TikToker on one of his podcasts without batting an eye. Like, he doesn't care.
He's just interested.
He's just interested in people. And I think that's what fuels it. And he's so passionate about the business that he's building there that it's hard to not. I mean, he's a very affable, enthusiastic guy. Yeah. Full stop. But that enthusiasm really comes through in the content.
And do you then have any dealings with Candy Kittens or, you know?
Yeah, so Jamie's obviously still very involved in that business, and so we work with Ed, his business partner, just making sure that everybody's aligned on.
So it's 360, sort of looking after every sort of aspect.
Yeah, or being aware of the other things. You know, he's got a few businesses, so being aware of what's going on and how he's most useful to those businesses as well. He's a really busy guy, so.
Is part of then the role, would you say, of talent management, future-proofing and sitting down and being strategic about what's going to be happening and where the goals, and is that what talent management, there are now lots, there are very small groups of talent managers, particularly post-pandemic, they've come up looking after TikTok talent, but as a talent, what would you say that your manager should be doing for you? And equally, why should you fire a talent manager?
Tricky question. I think your talent is, so the default answer is your talent manager should be writing a strategy and making sure that it's delivered. I think there's a bit of a tendency to write fantastical strategies that are impossible to achieve or never happen or get, I don't know, filed away and never brought back up. I think it's easy to do deals. If you've got a talent who is bringing in their own work, as in their inbox is flooded with opportunity, it's not hard to convert those into deals. Mm. Yes, you can be better at negotiating or not, but converting them is not difficult. I think creating opportunity where there is no demand is really hard. Really, really hard. You really cannot sell a talent to somebody who doesn't want to buy them. Mm. So obvious, but it is incredibly difficult.
That they should be good at negotiating. Responsive. That came up in the last interview that we did, that a good talent manager should be responsive and getting back to people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the fast, in our world, the fast turnaround is mind-boggling, and I think you can very quickly lose opportunities by not being quick enough. Mm. Because I think a lot of agencies go out to 10 different management companies and cast the net really wide, and speed pays dividends.
And would you say that there can be situations where talent aren't shown opportunities?
As in, they don't see the opportunities at all?
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Should that be a fireable offence?
I don't want to say any particular reason why someone should fire someone. It's a very personal decision. But I think...
Well, some people might not know what a talent manager... You know, they've just started out, they're naive. Maybe the talent manager is taking like 50%. You know, haven't seen any industry exactly sort of standards.
As you said, there's been a lot of small agencies pop up. There's just so many creators. It's no surprise, really, that there is sort of... There's a home for everybody. It's something I've really struggled with. I can't keep track of TikTok to sign people quick enough, because you think you found someone interesting, they're already represented and they've got 30,000 followers. And that's very difficult to compete with, that pace at which people are getting snapped up.
Is your roster now closed?
Never closed. Okay. I think right now we feel like we've got a really good roster, we've got a really good team, and it's sort of in a good place.
Yeah,
I think we're open to the right talent. I think what we will always struggle to do is bring talent up from really tiny. I would love to think that we could do that and we'd be really good at it. We definitely do have some examples of talent that fit into that category. But really, we're about representing the elite clients, and that's across the board at YMU. So
how many are within your team, not on the roster, but actually YMU social division?
So there's 8 of us. And the sort of, you know, an extension, there's sort of 3 people in the commercial team that sort of feel quite part of our team as well, because we work so closely with them.
And how many talent have you got?
20.
It's a nice mix.
It's a really good ratio.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of agencies, you know, I meet talent managers all the time. Oh yeah, I rep 13 talent. How? Yeah. I don't know.
How effectively?
Yeah, I just, your inbox. I don't know how you manage it, genuinely.
Well, speaking of inboxes, talking about talent who their inboxes are overflowing and it's not necessarily difficult to convert it into a brand deal, what would you say that we're seeing in the market at the moment in terms of quantity of brand deals, budgets that are coming in? There has been noise that budgets are sort of flatlining or dipping slightly as we are in the uncertain economic times.
We just had this discussion in our team meeting this morning. I think that is true in terms of nervousness to commit. The way in which we're seeing it is more, oh, can we add a break clause in?
Interesting.
Or can we add in this KPI whereby if X doesn't happen after 3 months, we can relook at the rest of the contract, which I've never really seen before. On the other hand, I feel like we're seeing more 6 month, 12 month campaigns than ever. It's the thing I've always wanted, always dreamed of.
Yeah.
And that has been, especially the beginning of this year, has been wonderful. So that sort of tells a different story.
Mm. Do you think that that might be an anomaly in the wider creator economy? And because YMU social is part of YMU, which deals with celebrity, and that celebrity talent have been used as ambassadors, and the value, earned media value of the association is there, so maybe the clients that you're working with already get that, so they're not constantly trying to drill influencer into performance.
I would like to agree. Sadly, I think we're seeing the same sort of briefs, and if I see another brief for one reel, 3 Instagram story frames, that is the standard. And it's really almost impossible to take that from one reel, Instagram, 3 Instagram story frames to a 12-month partnership. Because that, it's just at the point you've seen that brief.
Why do you think that those are the types of briefs that are coming in? Just because the numbers, it's very clear cut. Maybe that's what they have to go in with to then win budget and then maybe, you know, win 50K. But actually, can I advise you that maybe this shouldn't live on Instagram, it should be an integrated YouTube video?
Yeah, it's funny, I was just at a lunch with a brand who was saying like TikTok is doing extremely well for them in terms of virality, so a product will go viral and then fly off the shelves, and they're so lucky that that's the scenario, because that's sort of what every brand dreams of, I think. But they can't track it because they're not on TikTok shop.
Right.
So they see the massive spike in sales, they see the viral content, and they assume they're linked, but then there'll be a disagreement in-house about, oh no, marketing say, oh, we just put a TV ad about that product, that's why it's flown off the shelves. And I think they were saying the joy of Instagram specifically is how trackable everything is. And obviously that's got better over the years. And it's the same with YouTube of being able to track is just so vital now, whereas it just wasn't in the beginning.
Yeah.
It was sort of PR money and nobody was measuring PR in the way that they are now. And I think where teams have in-housed or the PR team has become the influencer team, I think all of that has blended so much.
Yes.
It's been interesting to see how that's shifted, and the sort of, I think, the move away from using agencies. We work with every agency ever, and some of them are brilliant, but we also love a brand direct relationship.
I was going to say, what sort of the proportion and breakdown of deals, is it predominantly brand direct, is it through ad agencies or specific influencer marketing agencies that most of the work comes through, or the pitches into talent?
Total mix. I think it's probably even across the board.
And do you have a preference?
Depends. I think there's a wonderful thing about a brand direct where you can ask quick questions and get them answered.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to go through 10 people. That is so precious in a when time is tight. If you've got a really good agency, I had an email from an agency the other day, who she said, "Oh, I've had the contract back from the brand, but I just disagreed with some of it, so I've pushed back." And I was like, "Oh, you're adding value. This is amazing, and you know why you've done that, and it's because it won't work for this talent, and I haven't even had to ask for it." And it's like, that's really valuable. So it just depends how great the agency is, and we see a mix in terms of briefs from.
What would you say has been your worst experience? A campaign brief that's landed, or an agency? Without naming names.
My mind goes back with that question to the early days when no one knew what they were doing, us included. And so every deal was sort of chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
And we learnt with every single deal. Every single deal. And then the industry sort of professionalised and it all got much better.
You mentioned that this year has been the rise in the 6 month, 12 month campaign. What are they seeking, these clients, in terms of, do they have a preference for TikTok as a platform, or are we seeing more YouTube? Is this the year of the rise of short form, or the continued rise with YouTube Shorts?
I don't know if it's because we're not a TikTok agency. I think representing TikTok is hard. It's like I'm going off on a piece on a tangent rather here, but you sort of have to sign 10 to get one that translates off platform, and I think there's lots of agencies who are doing that really well. I think we don't really think of ourselves as representing lots of TikTokers. We've got people like Francis Bourgeois and Shits and Gigs who are performing really well. Sophia and Chintzia, Girls Bathroom, they perform really well on TikTok. So we have them, but they also do lots of other stuff.
Yeah, other platforms too.
Yeah, lots of other platforms rather than that being their necessarily their main one. And so whilst we are seeing some briefs for TikTok, I think if we were a different agency, we'd probably be seeing a lot more, because that's the narrative in the market, is that everybody wants TikToks.
Do you think the clients are wanting TikToks? You referenced the brand whose products were flying off the shelves and that sort of virality. But that TikTok might be the place for eyeballs on a product, as opposed to, is the affinity to a TikTok creator as strong as a YouTube creator? You're watching somebody for, say, 30 seconds, or sitting down and watching something for 15 minutes. I did hear when TikTok headlined VidCon last year that the meet and greets that were for TikTok talent were significantly less busy than the YouTube ones.
Thoughts? Just nodded the whole way through everything Alice just said. Yeah, this is my big question mark around TikTok talent. I see very few that translate off platform, and I think it's almost impossible to build a relationship with an audience in such short form video. There are talent that are doing it. GK Barry is a really good example, currently touring, sold out every night.
Yeah, it's not saying it's necessarily the rule.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's sort of...
But also how we consume content has changed so much. So when I watch YouTube, I watch probably 4 people religiously, and it goes on my TV and I watch an hour long piece of content that, and I feel like I trust everything they say, but I trust their recommendations. I trust, you know, they're being honest with their audience. And I think TikTok's just a totally different form of entertainment. When I say TikTok, I also mean YouTube Shorts. Or
yeah.
It's not just not just that platform. But
somebody was speaking to me from YouTube recently, and they were saying that Shorts is the equivalent of someone standing outside of a restaurant with a platter, a tasting platter, and that you taste it, and then if you like it, then you'd go in to watch, eat the full meal, watch the full video.
That was someone from YouTube.
Yeah.
So my theory on that would be more that what you see on a YouTube short, i.e. what's been produced for that format, is going to be so different from their usual content.
Interesting.
Because you sort of have to create such different content. I think I was seeing as well, you know, people being like, oh, create a reel and stick it on TikTok. It's like, well, that's pointless because it won't perform. It really is a very different type of content. And you can see the struggle that some talent have had in working out at what their TikTok voice is.
Yes.
Because it's such different content, and it's the audience is expecting something different.
So sometimes people can think, oh, great, I can repurpose this content, but actually...
Yeah, it doesn't work. I think you're very lucky if it does, but again, that's the anomaly rather than the rule.
Because there are now so many platforms and places to be. As a creator, what would your advice be? Yes, there are all these platforms I can be on, but I only have so much bandwidth. Is that you should focus on key channels, or do you... You know, what we're seeing in the US is quite interesting. Companies, I think it's like Creative Juice, that are investing and taking equity in YouTube channels in exchange for them building up a team so that you can grow faster.
Yeah, or syndicating content across Snapchat shows. Yeah, I've never worked with one of those companies, although had lots of conversations. So I guess I don't know the reality of how successful that can be. I'm sure it can be. I think that my advice to creators has always been keep doing the thing that drives your revenue, and experiment with one other thing, probably. Unless creators are hiring teams, and most of them don't. Most of them edit all of their own content still, because that's what they've always done. They like that level of control over it, and they feel like they know their audience best.
Sort of diversifying, but without being overwhelmed. So then you can, you know, say the Vine creators, and Vine went under, or I think brand deals across Snapchat rumored to be down. Being at the hands of algorithms and platforms that you don't know. Back in the day, people used to own their own domains and they all have their own blogs. We are seeing a rise in newsletters now. Quite a few people doing Substack. What are your views on newsletters?
Yeah, I think any first party data is great. Full stop. So any way that you can capture your own audience, whether it's, I mean, Substack is still a platform, isn't it? But
yeah.
I think
they do have quite good rules around IP and things,
and data. So. Yeah, it's. I think that's the crux of it. Yes, it's extremely valuable if you can do that. I think very few people are doing it well, and it sort of gets overlooked because that's fine. I'll just spread myself across three platforms.
What are your, we talked there about first party data. What are your views on the platforms that are sort of databases of creators that have stats and are sort of act as search tools that brands buy, but it might not necessarily be first party or opted in, it's more of an API scrape?
I've never seen one that I've been impressed by. I don't know if that's because I can see the talent's data, because...
Yeah, that sounds like a great pull quote.
I'm going to regret that one. I think that because I can see the talent's data, as in we're logged into half of their accounts, I think that I just always feel like it's not quite right. And it's a similar feeling to, you know, the how many fake followers has... You put the same name into 5 different of those websites, you get totally different answers.
Yeah.
And it's not that there aren't bots, etc., but I don't think anybody knows how to measure any of these things. And that's okay. I think increasingly we're being asked, certainly by brands, to supply screenshots.
I was going to ask what data points that they want to see now. What post campaign do you send over? And that's
Yeah, it's because we, for those who are not logged into, we've got access to the Meta Business Suite. And even that's not really enough for the brands. They want to see the screenshot.
That's interesting.
Was there
a period of time, so it went from screenshot and then maybe it went into platform and it's come back out again to screenshot?
Yeah, I think so. Mm. And we get that request for pre-campaign as well. So can I have screenshots of analytics? So that's usually audience demos, but also last three sponsored pieces of content, link clicks. It's so specific. Mm. And I mean, we do share that if the talent are happy with us sharing it. But the level of data analysis even before, and they're not necessarily using the platform. How do you get link clicks through? You can't, from scraping an API. Yeah. And if that's the thing that you're being, as an agency, you're being measured against, you need to make sure you're booking the right talent.
Because I've spoken to talent in the past, I think we're probably again coming out of this, but say that a brand uses a data platform, and to be part of the campaign, the talent has to log into that platform. And one of the stories that came out of it was that that agency had posted on that creator's Instagram by accident.
No.
Yeah. And that she saw red.
Understandably. Mm. I think...
And she said, I would never share it ever again. So it's sort of the pushback and power in... power play, I guess.
I think with those requests, we contract separately and say, and put in a term saying our contract overrides the T's and C's of any platform.
Yeah.
It doesn't protect that from happening, but at least, because there's a lot of T's and C's related to signing up to those things, it's just a little layer of protection, but we try and avoid it, but sometimes it's not possible.
What excites you most about the industry at the moment?
I think the proliferation of talent. There's just so much talent. And I think there was probably a really solid period where there just wasn't. And it wasn't until TikTok, really, I think, that it got interesting. I think there was a lot of, beautiful girls on Instagram posting their outfits. And that's great. And it serves an audience and they have lots of followers.
We sort of went from entertainment to aesthetic. And then TikTok brought back entertainment.
Yeah. And I think that's exciting. Yeah, I think that's exciting. I think it's really hard to navigate. But that's okay. That's our jobs to work that stuff out. But I think that's the exciting thing. Suddenly it's like, oh, there's a pool to find talent in. And I think if you're a brand, that's interesting. And I think if you're a talent manager, that's interesting.
We talked earlier about signing, and you have lots of podcasters to get quite meta about it, what with... recording a podcast at the moment, but what do you think is so special about podcast? And we are seeing a rise in vodcast. You're seeing Spotify invest heavily into the space, very heavily. I think they spent a lot on Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's exclusive. Has that come out yet? Maybe it has, but I don't know if the brand deals within podcasts have caught up quite yet, or would you say that they're coming? Or
it's funny, somebody else said this to me. They said there's no money in podcasts. I was like, I think there is, but I think very few people make the money. And there's a lot of people not making any money, so it's not very uniform, I think, across the industry. And I think that's just because you've got some people who are doing millions of listens a month, and you've got other people who are doing 300 listens a month.
And then those brand integrations, is that sort of a read through ad, having the branding sit on all of the social clips, or like how integrated sort of be talking about the product during it? I suppose it was a microphone recorded on.
We see a total blend of all of that. I think the vast majority of stuff is a host read, it's a host read ad, or it's just an inserted ad. It's not that sophisticated. I think we're trying to have those conversations about our podcasters and sort of doing slightly more sophisticated deals where it makes sense. But I think I suppose
with the tools as well.
If you've got the audience, it's kind of, there's plenty of ways. Shits and Gigs, they have their Patreon that they have 10,000 people. So they could tell me off because that number will be wrong now because they're growing too quickly and I can't keep up. But 10,000 Patreons, they're all paying £3 something a month. Lovely.
That brings us on nicely to subscription platforms. So we've talked about Patreon, where people can support their favourite creators and get access to content ahead of time. But we've also seen Elon Musk has now taken over Twitter and has introduced Twitter Blue. And then recently, Mark Zuckerberg is introducing subscriptions on Facebook and Instagram. Thoughts on subscription platforms and will they work for Twitter and Meta? Patreon started as a subscription platform.
Yes, I think so. I don't know about Twitter just because there's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. What's going on?
What is going on? But I think, so Instagram subscription, for example, I think there's a lot of creators, and even in the UK market, which I think as Brits, we struggle with asking people for money, full stop. But I think that there is interest, and it's rolled out in beta at the moment. And apparently it's proving successful with really, really small groups, like book clubs and that sort of thing. Mm. So a small group about a specific topic rather than a more broader like fan club.
Yeah.
So I think it's just about how people are using them and doing so
strategically. I don't know if I've come across, or maybe some creators, but yeah, not UK. I don't think I've seen anyone UK with a...
There's a couple. Jim Chapman's doing it.
Is he?
Yeah.
On Instagram?
Yeah. Who else is doing it? Carrie Hope Fletcher.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure what everybody's serving to that audience.
Mm, because then what they are also rolling out is the ability to buy verified.
Yes.
Yeah. Like that's already happened on Twitter. Got followed by somebody yesterday. They had like 23 followers. I was like, oh, wow. Mm. You know, that's the blue tick is no longer maybe as meaningful. But then with Instagram, it's going to be rolling out so you get additional support and things like that. So what are your views on buying the verification?
Oh, it's complicated.
To be fair though, like us, I've tried to get verified on Instagram so many times. Like the awards goes crazy, the posts are everywhere, verified accounts, news organizations covering it. Mm. I can't get verified there.
Mm. It's all changed so much over the years. Like, well, now the entire creator team at Twitter has gone, so getting verified is impossible.
Mm.
Even before Twitter Blue became a thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it has changed a lot. It used to be really easy to get verified at TikTok, and now it's not.
TikTok headlined the awards in 2019, and it was before it had even sort of blown up. It only just rebranded from Musical.ly, and yeah, so we'll get you verified. I was like, oh, don't worry about that. Oh my God, what was I thinking?
Turn back time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I fundamentally hate the thought that people can buy a blue tick because it sort of devalues all the people who've legitimately got one.
What is the best campaign that you have ever worked on in your 10 years, 11 years?
I'm going for a recent one, which isn't a deal we did. But it's one I've just finished executing for Dr. Julie with Calm.
Love Dr. Julie.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
I love how that she has sort of five things in the points and she takes it off as she's going through each of a point. Then you're engaged for the whole thing. It's like just kind of watching and listening. It's very therapeutic.
It's very therapeutic. She's a clinical psychologist. And actually, therefore, her working with brands is really hard because she gets lots of requests, but how do you legitimately, she's still practicing, how does she legitimately endorse a brand? And it's always a bit sort of shoehorned in the we want an expert who could, something about mental health, helping the young. Oh, it all feels a bit like that.
Yeah.
Whereas this partnership with Calm, which was a deal not done by us, as I said, but it's the perfect fit, and they are a dream to work with. And she was really hired.
Calm. Yeah.
So working direct with Calm, their talent team are phenomenal. Mm. And because that's what they do, they work with talent all the time. So they're actually really incredibly slick at it.
Matthew McConaughey's Sleep Story.
Absolutely. And so they were wonderful to work with. She wrote scripts as a clinical psychologist, which felt very much in her professional, you know, comfort zone. She writes scripts for her TikToks and it's, you know, genuine clinical psychology. So yeah, it's been dreamy. And was incredibly well received by the audience because of that good fit, which is just a classic response of the perfect brand fit. is yeah. what makes the best campaign.
I hosted a panel once, and one of the talent said that the perfect brand campaign is one that fits so well that you would have done it for free.
Absolutely.
Obviously not going to do it for free, but...
But you would have. Mm. Completely. The one that you would have bent over backwards for. That's probably the example, and she's still working with them now, which is great.
Are there any brands that you would love to work with, have as a client, and that you haven't worked with before? Or do you think there are brands out there that haven't dipped their toe into the creator marketing sphere yet and should?
Good question. I think that it's the classic, when you take on a talent, who would you love to work with? It's always the same names. Or very often the same names. And they're always the brands that are really hard to get a deal from or impossible.
Because they're so big, or...
It's because everybody wants to work with Apple.
Yeah.
I want to promote the new iPhone. They need no promotion. They don't need to do that stuff. And I think that's the... those are the tricky ones, where they're gorgeous brands that everybody has an affinity with and is excited about, but actually they don't do much in the sort of influencer marketing sphere.
We did see a lot of creator press trips through a period of time. Do you think that is something that will continue? Sort of, there were the very luxurious ones to the Maldives.
Yeah.
There was actually one that was not long ago down in Hawaii. It may have been last year. There was a bit of backlash over it because... I think the Hawaiian people were saying, yes, please don't come to Hawaii. So it didn't fit quite right. But do you think in the economic climate, within some brand campaigns, it's please be aware of the cost of living, sensitive to cost of living. So do you think that maybe those type of trips won't be happening as much?
I think they will still happen.
Do you think they're good? Do you think they're effective?
I think they work very well for the brands.
Yeah.
Very, very well. I think probably lessons learnt from that example that you were referencing around that was just outrageous on every level. And don't get me wrong, I think that a lot of them are outrageous in terms of the spend that goes into them. But I think they return a lot for the brands. So as long as the ROI is there, I guess they're going to keep doing that. But I think that was an extreme that no one had ever seen before. And that was part of the problem. So there's one going on right now. Flown to New York. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of content comes off the back of that. But I don't see them going away.
Yeah. I remember speaking to a creator once who was on one of those trips and saying sort of at the beginning it was so exciting because it was new, and then you actually do realise the return that you are giving and that actually being taken out of work for a week on a trip, that now if she does go on... press trips like that she will be, she will have told them that she'll be creating other content as well. It won't be a competitive brand, but that branded content will be created.
Which brands hate.
Yeah.
They hate that, which I get because they've flown you business class or whatever they have to get you out there. But that is the reality.
Things if they had paid for the post or the content, that they could have flown themselves business class there anyway for a week's holiday probably.
Totally. And I think that's what we're trying to do with those types of conversations is guarantee content. So yes, they'll come, but we also need to get a contract out of this, which seems to fly on the whole, not for everybody, but that sort of works. And I think as well there used to be more intense itineraries on those sorts of trips, where I think there's a lot more downtime now. And that's the reality of them acknowledging that talent have to work whilst on those trips. But yeah, it works if it's an opportunity you would never do anyway.
So those are press trips. Creator events over the years, creator events, be creator. But you, I imagine, went to some of the original VidCons, Summer in the City. What do you think's happening on the sort of industry side and fandom events? And is it VidCon that's really servicing that type of fandom event now?
It's hard to say with VidCon because there hasn't been one in London for...
Since 2020, February 2020.
Yeah, a good couple of years.
They did Middle East.
Yes.
Middle East.
And obviously the US has has continued. So I feel a little bit like I don't really know the fan element of it, because I probably go in a slightly different industry type capacity, and yeah. It's really hard to get talent to go, because unless they haven't yet had an opportunity to meet their fans, and they believe that their fans are the type of people who would turn up to VidCon, why would they go?
Yeah.
And so I think that's shifted quite a lot. And maybe it's just because we're looking after talent who are slightly older demographic. They're all really young still. Youthful people. Mm. But, you know, from the sort of Brit Crew days, that was a fandom. And the only way to connect with the audience there was at an event like VidCon. And it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Really loved it. So I think that that's still happening. I think your point earlier around does it happen for TikTok talent in the same way? I think probably less so.
And then what would you say about on the industry side, the creator industry members? Do you think that they come together enough in the UK to compare notes, talk?
No, not at all. I think you'll have seen Phil Hughes, who was previously at Gleam and has now set up the Digital Creator Association. That's in response to that exact problem. And when we've been talking about it for ages, but then I started talking to other people. So Lucy Challoner at MC Saatchi, for example, we got together and I was like, oh, you know, there's this thing that Phil's doing. And she's like, well, why haven't we've never even been for coffee together. And actually, we've got so much shared experience and, like, opportunity to learn from each other that on a very basic level, we should go for coffee more.
Yeah.
And I think there's just been, I don't know if there's been a lot of competition. But, yeah, I don't know what it is, but I think we need to do more in that capacity to share learnings and experiences and come together on important topics.
Because they have the influencer marketing trade body, so this is sort of
the other side of it, totally. And I had that conversation with Scott where that's amazing, but you're missing the creative voice in that.
And so often, and that's can be one of the biggest frustrations for me in the space that it's talked about. It's like the whole reason this industry exists is because of the creators.
Yeah, and yet there's no formalized sort of organization way of communicating with them, in inverted commas, like that. And I think that's been a huge frustration for such a long time for creators. I can't get my point across. So hopefully we'll start to see that shift.
You do hear some agencies that know we're all about, it's just we're on the brand side, you know, it's brand actually. It's definitely a balance,
yeah,
I think, to be hard.
Yeah.
Where do you and YMU want to be in 18 months time?
Scared that was going to be 10 years time then.
Actually, maybe we will do 10 years as well. Where will the creator economy be in 10 years?
God knows.
It's only growing though, which is nice.
Yeah.
Having come from newspapers, it's kind of nice to be in an industry that's actually growing.
It's definitely growing. I don't know the answer to the 10-year thing. I constantly get asked, what's the future look like? I didn't know it was going to look like this. We're all working it out as we go along.
Would you say it's moving as fast as it always has done? Do you think we've sort of?
I think we've slowed down a little, but not in a bad way. It needed to become sustainable, so I don't think that's a bad thing. In 18 months, I would like us to see YMU to have a more global footprint in terms of our creative representation. Obviously, we've only been doing it for a year, so hasn't been going very long. And that meaning that we can service clients who sort of are US and UK. We've got quite a few on our roster who are have strong US audiences. So be able to serve them properly. I'd like a few more talent, but we'll see.
How would you like to be remembered by talent? What would your legacy?
I wish everybody could see my facial.
I'm talking
responses.
About your sort of like, it's either retirement or death. But how would you like to be remembered?
Definitely retirement. I'm a very empathetic person, and I would like to think that any of the creators that I've worked with or we've represented, wherever that has been over the past however many years, have felt genuinely cared for in a professional capacity. because I think that there's lots of horror stories about representation, and I think representation can be scary. I get quite a lot of DMs from people, I'm about to sign with somebody and I'm scared, and I don't, and that makes me a bit sad. Because it should be a wonderful partnership, and that doesn't mean it has to last forever. People, you know, grow out of agencies, or it's not right for one another anymore, and that's okay, but it shouldn't be scary.
A big thanks to Lucy for coming on the show.